I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. So what do the first 10 million presidential votes cast in the 2016 campaign tell you? We start with the simple math that 6 out of 10 votes in the Republican and Democratic primaries have gone to the disruption candidates in either party. Donald Trump in his hostile takeover bid for the GOP, and Bernie Sanders, the Democratic socialist trying to bend more than break the Democratic Party. Hillary Clinton has won more votes than either one of the rebels, but a lot fewer than the change agents combined. It's not yet a rebel alliance out there by a long shot, but the mission this radio hour is to know more about the shared impulses to jump the reins of conventional wisdom and party rules, to tip over the super PACs and the smug punditry that pointed to a coronation this year, not a volcano. What's the common ground between the Donald's roaring lament that we've lost the country and the dream, and Bernie's line that we've let the game get rigged for radical inequality? The behavioral economist Dan Ariely is our guide first to the predictably irrational side of virtually everything to do. He knows as much as the Rolling Stones ever did about why we so seldom get what we want or what we need when we buy, when we eat, when we fall in love, or, as I put it to him this week, when we vote.
When people make decisions or even voice their emotions, they're very much tied to the moment. Somebody could be slightly more entertaining on TV and we say, hey, we like them, or we become afraid of something and fear catches us. But we've been doing these studies for many years in which we ask people not to be in the emotions of the moment, but actually to be thoughtful about their lives. So, for example, if I say, what kind of society would you like to live in terms of the wage gap between men and women? People who do the same job, should they get paid differently or not? And most people say, of course not. We say, do you want to live in a country where if you're born poor, the odds of you dying as an infant are 10 times higher than if you're wealthy? And people say, no. Would you like to live in a place in which you don't have access to healthcare, to education at a young age, and therefore you're kind of destiny to a large degree gets sealed at a very young age? People say no. And we don't ask these questions like this. These are very leading questions. We just ask people to say, you know, what would you like the mortality of babies to be for people at the low 20% of the income and the highest 20% of the income, and so on and so forth. And what we find is that Americans are really wonderful, caring people. People want to live in a society that is just and fair and equal, that provides people with the opportunity for growth and health and provides services. And then you see about what we actually do, and there's a huge gap between what we say we want when we are thoughtful and contemplative and think about things in the abstract and what we do at the moment.
Dan, speak about the very special matter of fairness and inequality in this society. Your studies have shown among masses of people, we have no idea about the distribution of privilege, wealth, income in our country. Of course, we know subliminally and we're guilty about it at some level, but how do we deal with that? And how is it we've not dealt with it all these years?
Yeah, the simple experiment we do is we say to people, imagine that we took Americans and divide them into 5 buckets, the poorest 20%, the next 20%, the next, and the richest 20%. And we ask people to tell us how much wealth they think is concentrated in each of those buckets. So people, of course, know that the poor have very little and the rich have a lot, but they don't understand how much. So, for example, people think that the bottom 40% of Americans own about 9% of the wealth, where in fact the bottom 40% of Americans own about 0.3% of the wealth, basically nothing, right? They basically have no assets.
Debt.
So people know that the rich have a lot, but they don't know how much the rich have, and particularly people don't know how little the poor have. And when we ask people to say, like, what kind of country do you think is a country you would want to live in? What is a country that has kind of inequality that you want to be? People actually give a very socialistic country. They give countries with wealth distributions that are more equal than Sweden, and men and women are the same, and rich and poor are basically the same. And it's actually quite incredible to realize how much equality people want. Now, people don't want perfect socialism. People do think that there's a benefit of having incentives, and they want people who do better to want to do better and to contribute to society and so on. But people think that the gap between the rich and the poor should be much, much smaller than what it is. That there's no reason why a CEO should get paid, you know, 250 times more than the average worker in their company, or sometimes more than that. But what happened is that we think about things in that way when we are thinking about it in general terms. But all of a sudden, when we get to vote, we don't think about the general terms. All of a sudden, when we get to vote, we think about something specific, like, ooh, I don't think that it's fair for people to have welfare, and I think that we should cancel that, or I'm pro-life and I don't want people to kill embryos, and because of that, I'm going to vote in a very, very different way.
In this picture, Dan, along comes Bernie Sanders and saying, this is outrageous, it's unfair. Absurd privilege at the top, real suffering at the bottom. Let's change it. What did he do wrong? Or how might he have framed it differently?
I don't think he's done it wrong. And I think that, you know, 5 years ago, none of us could have imagined that somebody with his ideology would have gotten as far as he has. So, yes, it's true that he's behind and it doesn't look good. But I think it is an incredible step forward in terms of even having a discussion about this. You know, whatever happens to his campaign, I think he's done lots of good for the U.S. He's clearly galvanized lots of young people in a very, very important way, whether he gets elected or not.
Dan, could I ask, 2016 is such an unusual year. Along come Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, and they're both, in a way, taking on the irrational. Trump says, we're losing. We're losers. And Bernie says, we're grossly unfair. And you can see it. It's obvious. Sort out the rational and the irrational appeals and choices that they've given us.
Well, I think Bernie Sanders is talking about a real difficult plan that would take a very, very long time and could be very costly in the process. Right? So, yes, we do understand there's inequality, but solving this inequality is going to be very painful. It will demand changing tax structure. We will suffer in the short term. There's no question about it. And it's actually very hard for politicians to offer things that require short-term pain for long-term value. You know, it's hard for individuals, right? It's hard for individuals to ignore donuts and, you know, all kinds of tempting things. And in this country, we have elections basically every 2 years. So if you're going to say something that says, you know what, let's re-engineer the foundations of this country, we'll have 10 difficult years, but in the end of 10 years, we'll come up with something that is more equal and fair. Very few political parties would have the stomach for that. I think in China, the elections are every 10 years, right? That might be a better time frame to make some serious changes. That's on Bernie's side. It's clear that his vision is more long-term than 4 years in office, and it's clear that there will be pain in it. And in terms of Trump, I think there's something called emotional confusion there. There's something called misattribution of emotion. So there's an old study in which people kind of walked over a bridge, and this was a narrow bridge, a hanging bridge, very shaking, very frightening. And a woman across from the men who were walking on the bridge, and sometimes she met them in the middle, at the bottom of the bridge, and sometimes she met them after they finished crossing the bridge. And she gave them some survey about some questions, and then she gave them her phone number in case they were interested in finding out the answers for the survey. Now, nobody ever really cares about the answer for the survey, but people who met her in the middle of the bridge were much more likely to call her up. Why? Their palms were sweating, their hearts were pounding, and they basically said, why do I have this physiological reaction? I must be in love, right? So what happened is that we feel an emotion. We don't know exactly where the emotion is coming from, and we can attribute it to something else. And I think Trump is certainly creating that. I think, you know, the debates are emotionally charged. They get you to feel, not necessarily think, but they get you to feel. And then you say to yourself, why am I feeling this way, you know, excited, and why am I feeling amused, and why do I feel all this? It must be this guy. And all of a sudden, you basically attribute the emotions from the debate to the emotions you're getting from Trump. And, you know, it is very entertaining. It's so much like reality TV.
When you first did these studies, a major part of Mitt Romney's pitch was warning people against Eurosocialism. The strange part is, you ask them, 90% Republicans and Democrats, the readers of Forbes magazine, listeners to NPR, all want basically to live in something like Sweden. How do we get around this?
Yeah, you know, Sweden is an amazing country. It truly is. I'm actually heading there next week, but it's an amazing place. It's an amazing place because if you think about their economic development, you know, it's a country of 6 million people. Hmm. You can certainly name many industries that started from there, right? Of course, we have Volvo and we have Saab and we have Skype, and we have to really think about what are they doing right.
Is there a fundamental problem in democracy, letting a mass society, which is whipped this way and that by media, by fear campaigns, is there a fundamental problem with getting everybody in on a common decision?
So I don't think it's inherent about democracy. You know, if you basically say, let's have a democracy controlled by a group of people who don't pay attention to anything, that's, of course, a terrible situation. But I don't think that's inherent to democracy, but I do think we have to figure out how do we create a situation in which we do not allow the public to not think about the topics we need to think about.
Dan, your famous first book was Predictably Irrational. Does that describe American politics? And this year more than others?
Absolutely. Sadly, but absolutely.
That was Dan Ariely at Duke University this week. His new books are Irrationally Yours and The Honest Truth About Dishonesty. Coming up, we'll get a Change Gonna Come manifesto from the writer Ben Kunkel of The Rising Generation. Some say the Lena Dunham of literature. Heather Cox Richardson, historian of the GOP, is going to remind us that fairness is her winning word in this whirlwind. And then the only pundits I know who saw this turmoil coming most of a year ago, Pat Buchanan out of the Nixon stable and public citizen Ralph Nader. They've got unconventional readings that almost match as to Super Tuesday and the road ahead. This is Open Source. What becomes of the passion, anxiety, anger, hope that has driven the presidential campaigns through Super Tuesday? We went over to the last big Bernie rally on Monday night at Milton High School's Fieldhouse just outside Boston to feel the insurgent spirit.
I've been a socialist ever since the 60s, and it feels real good to be able to vote and express support for our fellow socialists.
I've never actually seen any celebrity or anything in person, so I thought it'd be cool to come. It was great. It looked like Bernie was glowing.
Basically, I really love his anti-war message. I froze to death in a lot of marches, and each of those times, Bernie voted against the war. And he thinks that the world is too small to have wars. They're outdated.
My daughter educated me on the value of what he was saying, and now I know it for myself. She told me that if you want the establishment, vote for Hillary Clinton. If you want to change, Bernie Sanders is the guy. She's a smart girl.
Because Sanders is building a political revolution, and that's what my generation needs. That's what everyone needs. It's fantastic what he's doing. He's the only one who's been honest throughout this whole campaign, the only one, and it's amazing. It's fantastic.
In fact, it was Hillary and her network that beat the burn in Milton and in the city of Boston and most of its suburbs on Tuesday. Bernie won Quincy. But where does the alternative vision go next? Back to the Dan Ariely point about common visions and the frustrations of realizing any of them in a democracy. This week, I asked the four-time independent candidate for president, Ralph Nader, how we'll ever get the government that Europeans seem to have. No, we are not Denmark, as Hillary reminded Bernie, but could we be the America we think we are?
It's very simple. Social Democratic parties in Western Europe after World War II, with the pressure of a viable trade union movement. Co-ops were large in those countries. They had multiple party systems that could push the major parties, proportional representation, easier ballot access. And that allowed people to reflect on the question, what kind of society do we want to live in? And as the economies grew, there was more distribution of the fruits, the productivity of these economies to working families. And there was a much broader safety net. So here are these countries, Chris, which were destroyed after World War II, and we emerged the victors in the most powerful country in the world. And these countries got, for all their people, the following, which all our people in the USA do not have. They got universal health insurance. They got better pensions. They got 4 to 7 weeks paid vacation. They got paid family leave, sometimes paid grandparents' leave. They got paid daycare. They got better public transit systems. They got better and fairer labor laws. They got higher real wages for the lower 1/3% of the labor force. And they got tuition-free education at the universities and colleges. Yep. And, you know, 60-some years after World War II, we don't have any of these. There are government agencies in Washington don't even provide paid maternity leave. So that's what we got to do. We got to say to people in this country, look, this isn't pie-in-the-sky Bernie Sanders socialist stuff. This is the kind of livelihood, the kind of quality of living that prevails in Western Europe and very often in Canada. So there's no excuse for that. So when somebody says, well, where are we going to get the money? Well, look at all the trillions of dollars of inert capital, trillions of dollars here and abroad that these corporations, these big companies have piled up, and they don't know what to do with. They don't want to pay taxes on them. They're not investing in productive activity in the U.S. They're not returning them adequately to the mutual funds and pension fund shareholders. They're engaging in stock buybacks designed to increase the value of their stock options. It doesn't do much for the shareholder, the studies have said. It's like burning money, hundreds of billions of dollars from Walmart to IBM to Exxon. Stock buybacks, one of the greatest scandals in the modern corporate economy. So it isn't Bernie pie in the sky. It's plutocracy on steroids in the U.S. And that's the kind of political revolution he's talking about.
What do we do with this energy, this outrage, this anger? We would have prayed for it, you know, 6 months ago. What are the possibilities of these populisms, right and left, meeting someplace?
Well, certainly in public opinion polls, Chris, there's a huge convergence on a lot of major issues. For example, the right does not like crony capitalism, which the left calls corporate welfare, bailouts of Wall Street, etc. That's a big convergence. That's a big ticket item. There's a left-right conversion against civil liberty violations under the Patriot Act. There's a left-right conversion about prison reform and criminal justice reform. That's actually going operational. Even Gingrich and Grover Norquist are involved in that with progressive partners at the state legislative level. There's a left-right convergence on the bloated, corrupt Pentagon contracting budget. There certainly is a left-right convergence on cracking down on corporate crime and fraud and abuse. There's a lot of convergence here. When you get down where people live, work, raise their families, they want clean water, they want clean air, they want decent consumer fairness and standards.
Peggy Noonan had a good line in the Wall Street Journal last weekend. She said, in America now, only normal people are capable of seeing the obvious.
That's true.
Ralph, who's the normal person, the normal people that help you see the obvious?
It was my parents. I had a lucky choice of parents. They had great common sense, to use the cliche. They had good judgment, and they basically saw things extremely clearly.
That was Ralph Nader, proud son of Lebanese immigrants who opened the People's Restaurant on the main drag in Winsted, Connecticut. The fiery conservative, Pat Buchanan, watches Donald Trump these days and sees the blossoming of economic nationalism that was Buchanan's own platform 20 years ago. Could it converge this year, I asked him, with Bernie Sanders' drive for economic equality?
I think there's a number of things that can. One is you've got to tighten our labor market, control the borders on illegal immigration, stop it. That tightens the labor market. The second thing you do is you realize that these enormous trade deficits, $800 billion a year, These are draining off factories and jobs and investment capital on the fairness front. You've got to start wages going up. But small businesses are the creators of most of the jobs in the United States, and corporations are creators of most of the jobs in the United States. And why do we have the highest corporate income tax in the world? It ought to be among the lowest so that corporations come here to produce here and provide jobs for American workers. I know this is Bill McKinley and Calvin Coolidge, but in the 19th century, I mean, they worked together, business and industry. So what I would say to the Republicans, faced with a choice between their working folks and their corporate folks, whose interests had suddenly diverged, they went with the donor class. They went with a transnational corporation. They went with Davos and Dubai, rather than going with Dubuque.
Speak to Dan Ariely's point that our fundamental social thrust is egalitarian, vastly unlike our social reality. And we've got to make an approach toward the Swedish ideal in all of our heads of a fair shake in an open society.
I don't know the way Reagan put it, but it was, what this country needs is a floor of decency under every family, but no roof over any man's head. I mean, it's the key thing we have to take care of is you take care of your own people, your own family, your own nation, your own country first.
Yeah. Pat, what is your kind of troublemaker credit to Bernie Sanders for stirring up his
side? He's doing a great job. I mean, let me tell you, when I was on the radio back after I ran the first time, I had a radio show down in the old Larry King studios, and we were battling against NAFTA on the radio. Whenever I couldn't get a guest, we'd call Bernie up, and he would come on. He was always good on that stuff.
What is the chance of a convergence here?
I think that the only chance left is now if Trump wins of any kind of convergence. Chris, what is so amazing, take a look at the turnout in the Republican primaries and caucuses. All-time records, huge in Iowa, in New Hampshire, in Nevada, in South Carolina, whereas there's been a shrinkage in the Democratic primaries and Democratic caucuses below 2008. And the point here is the Republicans are sitting on top of, and they're very uncomfortable with, a real potential majority if they can put together the Republican establishment and the traditional Republican conservative base with all these new people. It is enormous. But right now it looks like they're at war with each other. But if they drive those folks out, I mean, I don't know what happens to the party. I don't know what happens to the country if these people, and both Bernie Sanders' people and Trump's enormous numbers, if they find no expression in the presidential election of 2016.
What is the shift, the partisan shift, that would give the country what it wants, specifically a real change toward fairness and a stronger, more inclusive middle class again?
I think the Republican Party is too dominated by its donor class. I mean, what they do is they take advantage of all these voters, they toe the party line, they go out and deliver the speeches. And when the election is over, the country falls silent, and K Street speaks up. And they come around, say, we gave you this, and we don't care how you vote on Right to Life and things like that, doesn't bother us. But on TPP, you're going to have to pass that. We need that, and we need this, and we need that. And that's what we paid for. And that's what the party responds to. And Trump threatens that, and the movement he's got threatens that, just as Bernie threatens the arrangements in the Democratic Party.
That was Pat Buchanan, who was Richard Nixon's comeback speechwriter 50 years ago this summer. Back last August, Pat Buchanan and Ralph Nader told us, when nobody else did, that Donald Trump would give the Republicans fits this year. They also told us not to discount Bernie Sanders either. Hear it for yourself on our website, radioopensource.org. Our guest, Benjamin Kunkel, is a playwright and novelist who turned to perceptive public commentary in N+1, the magazine he co-founded, and in a recent book of essays called Utopia or Bust, A Guide to the Present Crisis. He's got solutions for anyone who will take the psychiatric exam, whether for liberal neurosis or conservative psychosis. Hold the manifesto, Ben, for a moment. First, this Dan Ariely maze of frustrated desire. If 90% of the country wants something like Scandinavian near equality, why don't we get it? Welcome.
Well, you know, I think those questions that... thank you for having me. Thanks for the welcome. I think those questions that Dan Ariely is putting to people, unfortunately, aren't being put to people except in sort of surveys administered by professors of psychology at Harvard or wherever Dan Ariely is. In fact, usually what's on offer in American politics, it seems to me, is these kind of, rather than our being like led towards a sort of reasonable expectation of understanding of what we want and a reasonable expectation of what we can have, we're instead encouraged to misconstrue in the most violent and unhappy possible way our opponent's own program and desire, which itself will be misrepresented, and that's one of the reasons it's easy to deliberately misconstrue it. And so, at least in the past, what's typically been done if anybody promoted something not even called socialism but any kind of mild scheme of redistribution was to say, well, in fact, this must mean that the person is a communist, and in fact, in the last 2012, there was all this stuff about Obama having had, you know, Marxist professors when he was in college and having perhaps like once met a member of the Weathermen. And so rather than having some kind of discussion about what kind of society we really want to live in, there's this sort of imputation that in fact somebody's trying to set us up in a kind of, you know, leftist terrorist organization rather than some sort of social democracy. So I think, American politics is not built for reason. It's built for hysteria and,
distraction.
Misconstrual.
Distraction, I was going to say. Ben, stand by. I want to introduce Heather Cox Richardson in our studio. She's a political scientist at Boston College, and she watches movement conservatives like a hawk. She told us almost a year ago that fairness would be the watchword of this campaign. That's a big, big, suggestive, underlying reality word, Heather, and it seems to be working on both sides of the line, despite all the trivia that Ben was just speaking about, all the detail. How's that happening?
Absolutely. Both sides are recognizing the fact that America is not now currently a fair society, that people at the very top have way too much, and both sides recognize that. But what also ties both the Sanders supporters and the Trump supporters together, and I think ties all of this discussion together, is the idea that what should drive and does drive American political behavior is narratives, stories about who Americans are and who Americans should be. And in fact, I think probably Dan Ariely is right, that Americans are wonderful, caring people. But also Ben is right that right now we are looking at narratives that are violent and unhappy about where America is going. And what both Sanders and Trump have done is, while Clinton and Jeb Bush, for example, are establishment figures, have sliced and diced the electorate and appealed to small groups of people without offering a national narrative, Sanders and Trump are offering stories about what America should be, and those are deeply emotional stories. You feel the burn. Trump's supporters are emotionally involved in his campaign, and that level of emotion and of caring comes from the stories that they tell and the fact they tell coherent stories that people can invest themselves in.
I'm fascinated. Ben, you may have a crack at this. Why does standard media always keep chopping up the electorate into tiny pieces to tell us what's going on? I may overdo the common threads in this situation, but it seems to me all these hundreds of fragments don't help us see anything. I was struck, you know, a poet and an image, a narrative can tell you more. Charles Simic, one-time poet laureate, Serbian by birth, but lives in New Hampshire, and he spoke the other day of seeing able-bodied men standing on their front lawn at noon on a workday randomly as he drives through New Hampshire. They're looking off in the distance and somehow suggesting exactly where we're at. Isn't that more useful?
I suppose so, although I'm afraid that what you're saying about us being one people and, a kind of a collective corporate in the...
No, we're going through one experience, though, of downturn and sort of lost ideals or something. Go ahead, Ben. Sorry.
Well, I'm reminded a little bit of what Obama was saying when he first came to national prominence with a speech he gave during, John Kerry's ill-fated nomination, and then when he became president himself, saying, look, we're all in this together. Can't we all get along? In fact, there's no reason for these violent disagreements among Americans. In fact, he was quite wrong about that, and his sort of conciliatory nature hasn't ended up serving him well. I think it speaks well of him as a person, but it means that he's misread the mood of the country. There are people. In fact, I don't think you can conciliate with the Republican Party as it is now.
It's not about conciliating, though, Ben. It's about telling the truth bluntly, boldly, plain language, it seems to me.
Well, I think the truth is sometimes that you're my enemy and not my friend. We live in the same country and you're a fellow citizen, and I don't want to throw you into a gulag, but you're my enemy and you'll be my mortal enemy.
So let's say it. Let's talk about it.
I think, indeed, we should say it. I mean, and the nature of creating a populism is always to say that some people are outside of the people. They're the elite. They're not part of the people. We are one people, and some people are not part of this people. And so I think that... it's maybe a time to make new alliances, but it's a time to sort of recognize that our enemies for who they are.
Stand by. We're talking about the road after Super Tuesday. Coming up, Ben Kunkel's Utopian Manifesto and Heather Cox Richardson's critique of it. This is Open Source in a campaign where a majority of the primary voters are upset, ready to act out and say why. So the question is, who among us is going to get what we want and how? Which is to say, over to you, Ben Kunkel of N+1. You wrote an irresistible article not so long ago that made it a sort of exercise in mental health. Would you take us through it?
Yeah, I will take you through it, and also tell you why I think that, while I hope I was right at the time, kind of characterizing what was going on in American politics in 2012 or so, I think things have changed. Basically, gross outline, I said that we're no longer, when we're conducting national politics, engaging in reasoned debate as people used to imagine a democracy would be. Instead, what we're doing is we're more in the position of shrinks trying to figure out what it is exactly that is going on in this person's head, which is clearly not what that person says is going on in their head. And so hence the significance of gaffes and slips, which were obviously very important in the early days of psychoanalysis. You accidentally said something that actually revealed the deep truth of what you felt. And so I think Obama would say something like, this is back in 2012, like, you didn't build this, about meaning to refer to the important role of the government in the economy. And this was taken unfairly and, of course, dishonestly to mean that, in fact, he was suggesting that job creators didn't exist. And, in fact, he was subscribing to the labor theory of value. It's only workers who do anything, as if he were some sort of true socialist. So I think that, and then there's Romney's great gaffe about the 47%, which revealed what he really thought. He's saying he wants to be the president of everyone. In fact, he just wants to be the president of people who pay taxes so that they can pay lower taxes. Now, I think things have changed. And so I was saying that, if we think of these parties in terms of mental health, you've got the Republicans who become the sort of party of psychosis. The GOP, I said, stood for the grand old psychosis. Basically, the psychosis means that you've lost contact with reality. And so there's all sorts of stuff about economic policy and trade, but really it's this great terror of, older white male Americans about losing their cultural dominance. That's, anyway, the kind of psychoanalytic interpretation of what's going on. I think that's true, and we certainly see that now having come to the fore with Trump. And then I sort of complain that the Democrats were neurotic in the sense that they simply don't know what they want. They're just sort of fumbling and uncertain, their aim inhibited, as psychoanalysts used to say. Now, I think this has kind of changed in 2016 in that you've got people, at least in Bernie and Trump, who are sort of straight talkers. Trump, rather than saying, I'll sort of be a dog whistle sort of racist, is, quite frankly, a racist. I know you may disagree with that characterization, but it seems to me a fair one. Bernie himself, rather than saying, well, you know, we'll just, well, we'll see. We'll try and create inequality or reduce inequality by creating some more charter schools or something. He just says, you know, we need to redistribute wealth. We need to tax wealthy people a lot more. We need to make college free. We need actual universal health care. And so I think that things have burst out into the open a great deal more than they had for a long time in kind of national electoral politics. And I think that's an exciting thing to see. So I think things have changed a little bit.
I welcome the roar, and I don't buy the notion that racism in Donald Trump's voice or his record is anything new, especially outstanding, remarkable about this campaign. That may be a different argument. Heather, react to the unleashing of a more realistic, direct, combative language all over the place. It seems to be working.
Well, it's very interesting, the idea that where we're coming from is a psychological disability on either the Democratic side or the Republican side, because I think actually if you look at what happened to American politics starting in the 1960s, what happened was that both the Republican and the Democratic establishments decided that it was no longer a smart thing for them to try and create large big tent parties. They talked about it, but really what they did is they looked at Nixon's election and said, well, look, he managed to cobble together enough people to vote for him, even though a majority voted for other people, that he got to be president. So what we really need to do is pull together voting blocks. When that happened, when the national parties walked away from narratives, what they did is they left open a big field for someone to tell a strong emotional story. And that's when the movement conservative stepped in with Nixon, with Pat Buchanan, with Barry Goldwater, with Ronald Reagan, with George W. Bush, stories in which hardworking white people's tax dollars were being wasted on minorities and women, especially African Americans. And you saw that with the Willie Horton ads, for example, or with the welfare queen, this division of the world into us and them and the small guy fighting against the empire. Now, it's no accident that Star Wars becomes the mega hit of 1977 and Reagan is elected in 1980. It's the same story. Without that national story being told by establishment leaders, by leaders who can say America believes in equality, America believes in fairness, America believes every kid should have a meal, these are things that matter to us, the movement conservative narrative took off. Now, this is the election when you have other competing narratives that, as you say, emphasize fairness, one from Bernie Sanders, one from Donald Trump, even though they're extraordinarily different messages. But this is the moment when we actually do, I think, have the opportunity to create a national narrative that is not, as Ben says, violent and unhappy, but rather lets politicians like Hillary Clinton now, if she would like to, and I think she is facing off against Trump, but other politicians to step in and say, no, what America stands for is this, fairness, equality, not for racism, not for beating people up at your rallies, for being a fair and even hand in the world.
Ben, what do you hear as a sort of emerging narrative of this particular season?
Well, I think, you know, the narratives, as Heather was saying, are both pretty clear. You know, and there on Sanders' side, it's that of the you know, emergence of tremendous inequality, economic inequality of a kind that is reflected, of course, in sort of differential outcomes for people of different races, and you know, also economic inequality for women. But I think, you know, the great Sanders narrative, and it's of course a true narrative, however simplified, is that of consolidation of social and economic power at the top. Trump's narrative, I mean, nothing Trump says for more than a couple sentences at a time is especially coherent. I mean, it'll be interesting to have a man incapable of consecutive thought running for office. I mean, it's not that he doesn't hit upon true things, it's just that he can't connect them.
Well, I'm not sure. I connect more than some people do, and I'm not a Trump fan. But let me suggest another narrative that I hear sort of rising is a kind of remorse hangover around Iraq. All the Republicans now are happy to say they hated that war. And Libya, too, which the New York Times is going to make an issue around Hillary. I also, competing with that, is a sort of rising narrative around, at least the meme du jour, around Weimar. We're entering our Weimar period. Fascism is a clear and present danger in the Trump, you know, presence. Speak of those, Heather or Ben, as as narrative frameworks that we're absorbing?
Well, first of all, certainly it's very interesting to me that Americans, especially on the right, keep talking about how America has failed, America has fallen, there's nothing left. If you think even back to the beginning of President Obama's administration, the suggestion that he or Mrs. Obama might have said anything at all derogatory about America was enough to sink them. So the very fact it's become the story that somehow we have to get back to some magical world, that's a very traditional, old-fashioned story of how does somebody take power? They promise to give you back something that you've lost before. But that is actually, again, part of the narrative, the movement conservative narrative that Eisenhower himself picked up and said, you guys can't go there. That, in fact, what you're really doing is you're creating the very language that a demagogue uses, and we cannot have that in America. That's exactly what Eric Hoffer pointed to in his book, The True Believer, that was Eisenhower's favorite book. You create a dispossessed people, either economically or culturally dispossessed. Then you promise them that they can get back to prominence so long as they turn against an enemy. And who the enemy is, as Hoffer said, doesn't really matter. And that's, I think, what Trump has picked up.
Ben Kunkel, pick up go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, I was just, you know, you mentioned Weimar. I'm glad not to have to be the one to bring it up. But, you know, of course, it was a big part of the, you know, German conservative known as fascist or Nazi narrative that there had been this stab in the back, right? That the German nation had been betrayed from within. And this was why they had lost the war, the previous war, and, you know, the First World War. And of course, you know, things are happening in both a sort of more compressed and maybe slower time frame right now. And obviously, I don't mean to make hysterical comparisons to Nazi Germany. But if we're talking about Weimar, it's certainly, you know, this sense of sort of national chaos and decline with a rising right-wing narrative of betrayal from within was part of that. And of course, you know, Trump says all this stuff about Obama being the worst president in the history of the country and how, you know, basically, of course, you would want to live in a great country. It's only really a traitor who would not want to make America great, not want it to have been great all along. It's quite treasonous, right, to want your country to be anything but great. And so the implication, I think, is that there was a stab in the back, and the stab in the back has been conducted by a mixed race person with a Muslim name.
I think
that's right. And I'd like to be Pollyanna here and point out that the first great lament in America about how terrible things had gotten and how we'd had to get back to the good old days was actually written in 1671. So it's not like this is unprecedented in American history. But what is different this time around is that what Trump has done is to harness to a national party for the first time in our history racism and the idea that we have to exclude people and actually physically get rid of them. Now, certainly that's been the case in American history, most dramatically with lynchings, for example, but those have not been obviously embraced by a national party as a policy, and that's very concerning. Still, I want to be Pollyanna and say Americans essentially are, as Dan Ariely said, wonderful, caring people, and the numbers we're talking about right now who are visibly supporting Trump, including, by the way, the KKK, so these are not necessarily people that we want to have being directing the body politic, but those numbers still are relatively small.
Leave it aside the question, which I would debate with you, of whether that really gets at the big narrative. Here's another possibility, as I listen to it, is the dread of a kind of permanent slow growth, of lowered expectations unto eternity, that we've got to manage the decline somehow. Trump is fighting that. I think Bernie would fight it too. And I think we all instinctively want to push back. How do you feel, Ben?
Well, I think, in fact, that's one of the great, I think, this may sound pretentious to say, but great world historical questions facing us right now. That, you know, we think of these great achievements that Ralph Nader was mentioning of social democracy after the Second World War, and they took place during a period of what's called the Golden Age of Capitalism, where you have the highest growth rates that capitalism has ever seen over its history, of whether you want to think of 200 years of industrial capitalism or 500 years of the whole thing. And that it's in that context that these social democratic societies were created. Any kind of social democracy or socialism we have going forward, I think, is much, much more likely to take place in a situation of slow growth or no growth or negative growth. And can that be done? Can you create a social democracy in a situation of, you know, stagnation? I don't know. I would like to see it happen, and I think if it doesn't happen, something quite ugly will happen. But I do think that this sort of great big macroeconomic climate has changed and probably changed for good.
I would agree with that. And I would also like, though, to point out, I have heard repeatedly how America has lost its empire status, how everything is not, you know, we have to get back to the good old days. I would point out that these good old days are only as far back as World War II. We are really looking at one, maybe two generations of people who knew America as a superpower, who knew America as the country to throw its weight around, who knew careers that lasted for an entire lifetime. That is brand new after World War II. And somehow the idea that we must preserve a moment that was, from its very beginning, limited and is itself a blip in American history is possibly impossible to begin with, but possibly not even healthy.
Ben? Maybe this is a moment just to say I'm not blind to racism or bigotry. I would put Donald Trump's unfortunate remarks in that area, though, in the zone of a 35-year war we have conducted almost continuously against Muslims, you know, and that is swept under the carpet, it seems to me, as soon as he says something outrageous like, you know, in the crisis after the attack in Paris, maybe we should cool the immigration for a moment, for a while, till it plays out, is roughly what he said. In other words, I think that's very selectively used. The question of Islamophobia and what it's done to us, untethered over this last three decades of our foreign policy, is a much more important question for me.
Well, and maybe let me take this one for a second, Ben, simply because I see what you're saying, and certainly that's played a huge role in American history fairly recently. But what Donald Trump has done and is doing with the, for example, 17.5 million followers of Breitbart somebody who's taking on anybody who comes against Trump. They are physically threatening our fellow citizens, and I mean physically threatening and threatening their lives in such a way that there are significant numbers of Americans who are afraid every day because of them and who honestly worry about the physical safety of themselves and their children.
For doing what? Or being
for what? Being black, for being female, for being a liberal even. Those things are not academic once you get outside of the Beltway and out of the East Coast. And it worries me to hear people not take that very seriously.
Ben, I mean, it upsets me to see Hillary Clinton being rude to the Black Lives Matter protester who entered her, you know, fancy all-white cocktail party. I think we can all recognize those things, but still, the big narrative is going to be decisive, and it's not that, in my view. Ben?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, I mean, this is always tempting to say towards the end of a conversation. I think you're both right. I think that it's true that...
I'm never sure I'm right, but go ahead.
Well, you know, you're quite right that whether or not it's been racist in motivation, obviously American foreign policy has really punished Muslims throughout the West, you know, especially in the Middle East.
With millions, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of casualties, I mean, deaths. It's serious.
Yeah, I think, you know, sometimes we feel that we, you know, sure, maybe Trump would say rude things, but actually be an isolationist in his foreign policy, and that would be good.
Don't we hope,
it's
yeah.
It's hard to know what he would do, and it is clear that he's making these appeals to sort of extra legal violence. I mean, they're rather, you know, there are only a few of them so far, but, you know, people are physically removed from his rallies. People, you know, beat up, some supporters beat up a Latino guy in Boston, and he says, well, my supporters are passionate. And, I mean, I don't know whether a Trump administration would mean, you know, violence abroad and violence at home or just violence at home, but neither of those seem like very good choices.
Heather, you get the last word quickly.
I hope we discover that, in fact, Americans are wonderful, caring people and not violent and unhappy ones.
Let's hope. Thank you. Heather Cox Richardson in Boston, Benjamin Kunkel in New York. Thanks also to Pat Buchanan, Ralph Nader, and Dan Ariely. Thanks to Tom Dodge of FOR Media for his help this week. Our show is produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, and Abby Duker. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.